According to his power that is at work within us. To him be glory.
Hello and welcome to today's podcast episode titled Anticipating, Recognizing, Evaluating, and Controlling Confined Space Atmospheric Hazards. I'm your host, David Griffith, and I have two expert guests today, Jerome Speer and Arlen Seert. Jerome is the president and founding partner of Speer & Lancaster. He's a certified industrial hygienist and a certified safety professional. He's an industrial engineer from Texas A&M and has a master's in business. Jerome is the current chair of the AIHA Confined Space Committee. Dr. Arlen Seert is with us today as well, two expert guests, and Dr. Seert got his BS and PhD from Colorado State University in industrial hygiene with a master's in safety, and he is a CIH and CSP as well. He was a Navy industrial hygienist reporting to the Navy's marine chemist, the Navy's confined space expert, and was trained as a Navy gas free engineering technician to work in carriers and submarine confined and enclosed spaces. He is the principal industrial hygienist at XL Energy, a confined space matter expert, and he directs and oversees numerous confined space, flammable, toxic spray painting, and other hazardous atmosphere-related projects. He's a member of the AIHA Confined Space Committee, and he's presented on confined space, flammable, toxic atmosphere precautions at international, national, and regional conferences. I want to welcome our two guests. We're fortunate to have both Jerome and Dr. Seert. Welcome.
Hey, Arlen. How you doing, buddy?
Great. Glad to be here with you, Jerome and David.
All right. Thanks for being our featured expert here. And you're up in Colorado attending remotely, right? How's the weather up there?
Really nice right now. I'm glad I'm not in North Carolina.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, great. So, Arlen, what are some of the more unique confined spaces you've encountered?
Well, I have about four categories of confined spaces. As part of the power plant generator overhauls at power plants, we must spray the interior core and end windings using highly flammable and acutely toxic coatings by necessity. Fossil plants have horizontal cylindrical generators, whereas Cabin Creek Hydro has vertical generators, which have rescue implications due to their configurations. Immediately dangerous to life and health or IDLH atmospheres are encountered involving flammability, where if you exceed 10% of the lower explosive limit, that's an IDLH atmosphere, and also from toxicity IDLH levels. And airline respirators with grade D breathing air are required here. I also do a number of tank projects with challenging egress and ingress openings. Then at Denver International Airport, we have about 325 underground interconnected electric vaults, especially on the concourses under the concrete, that due to fluctuating high water tables flood with water contaminated with propylene glycol de-icer, jet fuel, and solvents. Microbial breakdown generates flammable methane and toxic hydrogen sulfide gases and oxygen displacement deficiency from carbon dioxide. And I've also had carbon monoxide from jet exhaust enter the vaults and even our airline respirators. Two of the vaults have experienced explosive methane fires, even blowing off a 275-pound manhole cover in one case. And there, I require airline respirators with grade D breathing air and quick emergency extraction from these manhole vaults is a challenge, being the only opening is 3 foot in diameter through a long shaft. At our fossil plants and hydros during overhauls, I also have large underground pipelines and components bearing water that are blasted and sprayed with protective corrosion-resistant coatings designed for immersed applications. Lockout-tagout because these areas can flood when you're working inside them, and ventilation and communication between entrants and attendants and rescuers is a challenge. And then interestingly, we're planning a large number of very tall steel transmission, power pole, blasting, coating, refurbishment projects. And these electric transmission towers can be 130 feet tall, involving up to 15 levels of surrounding tented scaffolding. We have to spray highly flammable, acutely toxic, corrosion-resistant coatings, and emergency egress rescue is a challenge here.
So that's what's unique about that one as far as spray painting the transmission poles for power lines. You're actually creating a confined space where you're doing the work. Is that right?
Yes, because we have to tent them due to weather and carrying temperatures and heat them. And you, similar to an asbestos project, your entrances are Z-flapped poly, flame-resistant poly entrances. So it's it actually is hindering your egress and in a case where you might have to, in emergency.
Interesting. So I'm sure we're going to talk about that a little bit later on as far as your rescue plan for that type of project. Is that right?
Yes, and obviously if there were a fire, you can't just climb down 15 levels of scaffolding inside a tent. Where I spec'd a required external stair tower adjacent to the scaffolding so you could immediately exit from each level.
Interesting. So confined spaces are clearly dangerous places. What are some of the hazards that can be encountered in confined spaces?
So the most frequent type of serious hazards is what we call atmospheric hazards. And that's going to be the primary focus of the podcast today, because it is the most frequent type of hazard that we encounter in a confined space. But there's other types of hazards, such as engulfment hazards, such as water, or like grain bin silos, or even when I was at CBI, we built LNG tanks, and inside the antler, it's an inner tank inside of a larger tank. In between the walls of the two tanks is called the antler space. And after the tank is completed, they pump in perlite, which is a granular material, inside that space. And somebody feeds the hose. And we had occasion where a subcontractor had fallen into the antler space and suffocated because of this engulfment hazard. So you have atmospheric hazards, engulfment hazards. You could have physical hazards, such as mechanical hazards, crushing type of hazards, depending on the mechanical nature of it, entrapment hazards, radiation. Essentially, any type of hazard just becomes quite a bit more of a high risk when you're dealing with the confined space.
And we'll talk more about the atmospheric hazards later, but all right, what type of atmospheric hazards can be encountered? So what are the causes or sources of atmospheric hazards?
Well, Jerome, you've had extensive experience with welding inside tanks and other confined spaces when you were with CBI, Chicago Bridge and Iron. Chronic exposure to welding fumes is a serious health hazard. You've also had extensive experience with acute hazards, including solvent cleaning and painting. How about if you explain this important type of distinction and the ramifications?
Sure. So there's different types of atmospheric hazards. It could be an oxygen deficient hazard, which is one of the more common hazards and issues in regards to confined spaces. You could have a flammability or a combustible or explosive atmosphere, whether it be a solvent, flammable solvent hazard inside of a space, or flammable gas, or even a combustible dust hazard. You can have various different toxic hazards, such as hydrogen sulfide, carbon monoxide. What else is there? Arlen ammonia.
Chlorine.
So essentially you have oxygen deficiency, flammability hazards, and various different types of toxic hazards. And that could be, it's, of course, it's going to be dependent on a particular space that we're dealing with. And then you have the acute versus chronic hazards. Now, chronic hazards, now how the OSHA defines the atmospheric hazards within the confined space standard is that as an acute hazard that impairs your ability to self-rescue. So under the provisions of OSHA's confined space standards, a substance such as welding fumes, which purely has a chronic hazard, which does not infect your impairment to self-rescue, would not be covered by this definition under OSHA's permit required confined space standard.
Okay, so a wide range of hazards. So an interesting introduction, just from our experts. We're going to move to mitigating the risks of confined space incidents through effective planning and training. We'll continue to talk about the hazards. And really first, we'll ask, how do you go about evaluating the hazards for a particular confined space?
Okay. Well, the first step is to, each confined space is unique, and each one has to be evaluated by a qualified person. Someone has their necessary experience and qualifications to anticipate, recognize, and evaluate the hazards of the confined space and the work that's being performed. Not only the hazards that's inside the space, but also any work that's going to be introduced or hazards that will be introduced into the confined space. So that has to be recognized. And based on the hazard, then there's different methods to evaluate those hazards, different instrumentations, different sensors, and things of that nature. And it is important to, when you're dealing with an atmospheric hazard, the hazards can be stratified within the confined space. Some gases are heavier than air, so they would accumulate near the bottom. Some are lighter than air, so the hazards, the gas will accumulate near the top of the space. Some are about equivalent with the air, so it's important to test the air at different levels within a confined space, and also recognize, you know, what types of hazards you're dealing with and what are the physical properties of that particular gas or vapor.
So what are some ways to eliminate or control the atmospheric hazards in confined spaces? And if you could say something about these acute hazards versus chronic hazards.
Well, the primary ways is to, as far as control, is to limit the amount that you're generating inside the space and ventilation. So those two parameters make up the concentration or determine the concentration. And you can also, I mean, obviously, if there is an atmospheric hazard, there's a need to evaluate or monitor the air inside the space for whatever hazard you're going to be expecting. Typically, we have multi-gas meters that's calibrated before each day's use. And virtually each meter will have a sensor for the oxygen level, a sensor for combustible gas, a sensor for a toxic, and maybe another sensor for another toxic, such as carbon monoxide or hydrogen sulfide.
Interesting. So you're talking about the importance of continuous monitoring of the atmospheric hazards. So talk about this testing, the reliability, the approach, the calibration, just things that you've had from your experiences.
Well, an important concept is that the most common combustible gas indicators cannot accurately detect percent lower explosive limit, percent LEL, in oxygen concentrations less than 10% oxygen. So always look at the oxygen levels first. When low oxygen is present, either infrared IR atmospheric testing devices must be used instead, or oxygen introducing tubes may be used in the sampling train of conventional CGIs, combustible gas indicators. And continuous atmospheric testing is necessary because atmospheric conditions can change very rapidly. For example, on the dozens of generator spray and flammable coatings inside confined or enclosed spaces projects, we've experienced the atmosphere suddenly going from 0% LEL or a very low percent LEL to greater than 10% LEL within minutes. And this is always unsettling when this happens. So you got to pay very close attention to this. At DIA, we've gas tested the headspace in partially flooded underground vaults, initially detecting 0% LEL. Then after hydro vacuuming with a vacuum truck and a 6-inch hose to suck the water out, as soon as we suck the water out, we've had cases where all of a sudden the atmosphere increased to 100% of the LEL. We believe that this hydro vacuuming, where we're getting the water out before we enter them to clean them of the toxic corrosive sludge that causes electrical fires, we believe what went on was the negative pressure of the hydro vacuuming hose created a vacuum inside the vault, and these vaults are all interconnected to other vaults 50 feet away from each other underground, and they're interconnected with 6-inch diameter hollow PVC conduit that's poured into the concrete walls and laid in the soil between the underground vaults, and it's made to pull electrical cables through. But what it also does is allows water to flood from one vault to another, and they share air similarly too. We think in a case like this, the vault that we were sucking dry to clean didn't have methane or hydrogen sulfide in it, but once it became negative pressurized, it pulled air from adjacent vaults. Why were those 100% LEL? Probably because they're closer to a de-icing pad where there was a lot of propylene glycol that got into the water infiltrating those adjacent vaults. And the anaerobic decomposition of bacteria can produce methane, with methane fixing bacteria, and hydrogen sulfide with sulfide fixing bacteria. We've also had oxygen deficiency where there was no hydrogen sulfide and no methane, no percent LEL. How could that happen? Aerobic bacteria decomposing organic chemicals and creating carbon dioxide that displaces oxygen. And you can also have extensive rusting consume oxygen too. So almost every project I've had, including at DIA and all these spray painting projects, we've experienced failures of instruments or cross-sensitivity false alarms of instruments. It's important to understand these instruments thoroughly and have backup instruments readily available. I've had cases where in generators, we got some overspray on the instrument and it would alarm for carbon monoxide, even though there's no carbon monoxide there. And I'd have to validate that by testing with other instruments that weren't being used inside. And in cases where we couldn't get the carbon monoxide cross-sensitized sensor to quit alarming because it's sensing alcohols and paint coatings or hydrocarbons, we'd actually either have to disable or remove that sensor, but you can all, because you have to be able to hear the percent LEL sensor going off. And so you got to be really careful if you're going to disable sensors and prove that you really don't need them in a case like that. Also, CGI's span gas calibrated using the most commonly utilized methane gas nowadays because of the oil and gas industry. And even services like safety services where you rent these instruments or have your own calibrated, they'll just blindly calibrate them to methane unless you tell them otherwise, even though they should know better than this and should ask you what you're going to use it for. So a methane calibrated CGI can underestimate the true percent LEL for paint or cleaning solvents by up to 50%. So for use with paint or cleaning solvents, percent LEL must be span gas calibrated, either using pentane gas or methane gas with an instrument adjustment to a pentane gas equivalent.
Spear & Lancaster is an expert safety, process safety, and industrial hygiene consulting firm dedicated to helping organizations increase profits using risk management and incident prevention techniques. Spear & Lancaster has over 60 years of combined experience assisting hundreds of national and international organizations in achieving greater profitability by reducing workplace risks. Welcome back to our podcast, Anticipating, Recognizing, Evaluating, and Controlling Confined Space Atmospheric Hazards. We left off at, after outlining a number of hazards and the monitoring of the hazards, we want to make sure there's adequate ventilation. So I wanted to ask our experts, what are the challenges with configuring temporary ventilation systems in a confined space, and how do you ensure adequate ventilation?
Well, the first thing I do is inspect the space for openings for entrances and emergency egress, and openings for exhausting air from the space to safe locations and for bringing in fresh makeup air. I will sometimes use push-pull ventilation in larger spaces by blowing air in at a lesser CFM or cubic feet per minute rate than the exhaust system's higher CFM to maintain a slight negative pressure in the space, because I don't want flammable toxic vapors leaking out of the space near ignition sources or unprotected personnel. In small spaces, you can only insert so much ventilation, and you can actually spray paint faster than you can ventilate in some cases. So you must control the spraying rate at times, keeping a close eye constantly on percent LEL. The Navy Gas Free Engineering Manual and the old AIHA Confined Space Manual specified 20 air changes an hour as a starting point for any type of internal work. On my first fossil generator project years ago, I discovered 26 air changes an hour, and that's all the ventilation we had with us to utilize. 26 air changes an hour was not near enough, because we had six excursions where we exceeded 10% LEL, which is the ideal H for flammability, with mandatory space evacuations in each case until the instruments went down and the space purged out. And then I had to keep instructing the spray painters, you got to spray in short bursts, not continuously. And then later our organic vapor badge results came back from the lab indicating we had toluene exposure levels above the ideal H for toxicity. I had everyone in airline respirators with escape bottles. Now I often use much more of a ventilation rate depending on the situation, ranging from the 40s clear up to 75 air changes an hour. You must be able to actually measure ventilation rates to determine the CFM for each system, cubic feet per minute. And there's a formula called Q equals A times V that I use. So let's pretend you had four fan systems with ducting for each. You would measure this. You would determine the CFM for each system separately and add them all together. But in order to determine the CFM for each system, you take the duct, round duct size and diameter, which is called A, and you can look up on engineering tables on the internet, or you can calculate it with a formula. A is equivalent to the surface area in square feet for a round duct. So let's pretend you have 1 foot diameter, 12 inch diameter ducts on each of your fan systems, or you're going to look up that A value for in square feet for a 12 inch round duct, and you're going to multiply it times your measured velocity in feet per minute that you determine by duct traverses by boring a hole through flex duct coupling where it joins together, or holding it at the exhaust end and doing the duct traverse. Then you add all your systems, individual CFMs together, and you take that total CFM, you multiply it times 60, and you take that product and divide by the space cubic volume in feet, and that's your air changes an hour. Jerome, you deal with spaces much too large to apply this many air exchanges. Could you describe what you would do in some of these scenarios?
Sure. Air changes per hour is not a, in my view, a critical parameter unless it's a, you're trying to purge the space from an existing contaminant. For instance, you have an initial concentration, and then that's where the volume of the space comes into play. So the air changes per hour are dependent on the volume of the room and the ventilation rate. So, but the steady state concentration is merely the generation rate divided by the ventilation rate. So if you have, if our generation rate is milligrams per, at, you know, some number at milligrams per meter divided by the ventilation rate, which is in units of cubic meters per minute, then your ultimate steady state concentration would be cubic meters per minute. And that's a concentration value. So if the only hazard you're generating is spray painting in a hazard, so you have a generation rate and you have a ventilation rate, then it's going to reach a steady state concentration pretty much instantaneously. So in large spaces, if you use a criteria of 20 air changes per hour, that's not going to be feasible. You're not going to reach that. So I think a more important parameter would be the actual ventilation rate in terms of CFM or cubic meters per minute. Now, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for underground construction work, like such as in tunnels, they have some criteria as far as required mechanical ventilation inside of a tunnel. And their criteria is 200 CFM per person working, which I'm not sure where they, what basis they use for that value, but nonetheless, that's their criteria if you want to work on a Corps of Engineers project. And then each work area must have an air velocity at a minimum of 30 feet per minute. And so I use that criteria when estimating what the concentration is going to be for some work, such as a sawing operation inside of a tunnel that involves concrete work. So using a jackhammer operation and a sawing operation, and looking at studies to get the emission rate. And then based on the parameters, the minimum parameters that the Corps of Engineers require, then I use that as the minimum ventilation rate that we're going to achieve in there. We can measure the air velocities inside of space with an anemometer or velometer and follow up with actual air sampling data. But that's kind of a starting point as far as when we're planning a project. And the Corps of Engineers does require a ventilation assessment plan, which would require you to estimate what is the ventilation that you plan to use inside the space adequate. So you're going to have to estimate what the actual concentration is ahead of time. And just to follow up on what Arlen mentioned as far as the ventilation rate, that parameter, measuring and estimating the ventilation rate, is perhaps most difficult parameter to estimate, and one that we have probably had the most uncertainty when, because a lot of things can happen. We can have short circuiting if it's not set up right, or if it's not configured right, where Arlen mentioned a push-pull system. So what you want to do is you want to direct the contaminants inside the space where they're going to naturally want to flow. So if you have dealing with a gas or vapor that's lighter than air, you're going to want to be exhausting air out near the top of the space and pushing air near the bottom of the space. But you also want to make sure you have good mixing inside the space as well. And so, but if you're dealing with something that's heavier than air, then you want to reverse that. You want to exhaust it from near the bottom of the space and blow air in near the top of the space. So yeah, keep that in mind.
Fascinating information. So our next area is ignition sources, and an ignition source is often the start of a tragic incident. So we want to talk about eliminating ignition sources, including bonding and grounding. So what is bonding and grounding? Why is it so important? And, you know, what about equipment we use that's more intrinsically safe or explosion proof?
When ventilating flammable vapors through ducting or spraying flammable liquids through hoses, electrostatic charges build up and can release sparks. This is the same thing that happened when you're a kid and you shuffle your feet on a carpet and shock your brother or sister with your finger. That's a spark. Exhaust flexible ducting must be manufactured to be flame resistant and carbon coated electrically conductive with integral bonding wires that are form the spiral helix inside the flex duct and terminate at each end of the flex duct with attached protruding wires with little alligator clamps on each wire. And be aware there's a lot of counterfeit ducting out there, and genuine ducting should be made in this country, and it should always be black. And it's gonna look like this. Otherwise, it could be made in a foreign country and be counterfeit. And it isn't bondable, groundable. Each section of the ducting is both connected together to each other section by couplings or lashing. And then further, you have to connect them together with these bonding wires from each section by clamping them together. And then the duct end of a flex duct connected to the fan has a bonding wire clamped that must be clamped to the fan grounding lug. A grounding wire must then be run from the fan lug to a reliable proven grounding source of bare steel. If it's painted steel, you have to grind off the paint coating if it's or galvanized if it's must be ground off. There are these diamond tip clamps that are very powerful that are supposed to gouge off paint, but I don't know that I'd want to rely on that without grinding paint off or finding unpainted steel. Similarly, spray guns, hoses, and clamps and nozzles must be made of conductive materials and grounded to dissipate electrostatic charges. And it's amazing how many painting contractors don't know anything about this. Jerome has a great article on his website explaining all of this. Jerome, could you mention this article and how they could find it on your website?
Sure. I wrote that article several years back. I think it was after I investigated an incident that involved a transferring of a flammable liquid inside of a tote, I believe, and the fire erupted, and the guy was caught on fire and had severe burns as a result of it. So I wrote that article probably about 15 years ago or so, but it's by far the most popular web page on our whole website and has been consistently for a number of years. So. Yes, bonding is important because whenever you have a difference between voltage potentials, and that's when current flows. So you want to keep any surfaces and the material that's flowing through the, whether it be air or a medium or gas or a liquid, that have the same voltage potential as the surface that's flowing through. That's the whole purpose of bonding and grounding. So you keep it at the same voltage potential so you don't have the potential of generating a spark or potential for electricity to flow from one medium to another, which then you have potential for a spark to occur.
As far as the intrinsically safe explosion-proof equipment part of the question, all fans, lighting, flashlights, headlamps, PAPR, that's powered air purifying respirators if they're used, tools must be explosion proof, intrinsically safe, and non-sparking. You can have electric fans that are explosion proof. You can also use pneumatic fans I've used also that are powered by compressed air and are inherently intrinsically safe. But there's been a lot of fatal accidents occur from igniting flammable vapors by using even like drill drivers for mixing paints or other purposes that aren't brushless. Brushless are intrinsically safe. Traditional brush drill drivers, impact drivers are not intrinsically safe. You can even see the sparks flying inside the compartment with the brushes.
That's great content, yeah. Well, that was great insight on eliminating ignition sources. We're going to move on to rescue procedures, equipment, and personnel. Why is a rescue plan important? And when should a rescue plan be implemented? And what should it involve?
Rescue plans are extremely important. And as an example, on my first generator painting project, I flew in a rescue team from California that was the only one available. The local service was on another project. And they came in at the last minute only equipped with self-contained breathing apparatus. And some only had FR clothing with short sleeves. So an add-on to this generator project, at the last minute, they said, you've got to paint the bushing box too. Well, that's underneath the power plant generator on the floor below it. And it's you have to access it by scaffolding. And this was a last minute add-on. We didn't know we were going to have to paint. So the rescue team could not get inside the bushing box if they needed to, because the only two openings were only a foot and a half by a foot and a half each. They would have had to be trained and equipped with airline respirators, which I had the painters wearing, with escape bottles instead. So rescue teams are required for permit spaces where rescuing entrants may be necessary because there's acute type hazards that could impede their ability to self-rescue or even cause a fatal exposure or a fire. There are external extraction methods where entrants wear harnesses and lifelines and may be pulled out of horizontal spaces by hand manually or out of vertical spaces with vertical openings using tripods or davit arms, which are extraction devices with winches. At times, a rescue team may need to go in after them where external extraction is not feasible. For example, if there's internal objects that you could be hung up on, you may not be able to wear lifelines and harnesses, like in the bottom of some large ship baffles or compartments. They had baffles where you would have to go in after them in a case like that. And you might have to wear airline respirators with escape bottles if you can't fit into the openings wearing SCBAs. So the rescue team members have to wear the same flame-resistant clothing and respirators as the entrants. And at least one rescue team member must be current for first aid and CPR. And the whole team must undergo annual drills similar to the spaces to be entered.
Interesting. Yeah, related to the rescue plan is the training. And we want to ask, what type of confined space training should be provided?
Well, as we know, you've got different roles for different participants, like entry supervisors, attendants, entrants, rescue personnel, atmospheric testing personnel. And so they all have to be trained to their particular responsibilities. And there's other ancillary OSHA requirements too, like hazard communication, PPE, respiratory protection, lockout, tagout, the confined space or permit required confined space standard. There's electrical standard, the electrical standard 1910.307 on electrical hazardous classified locations that talks about explosion proof, intrinsically safe equipment and bonding and grounding. You've also got flammable liquid standards. And what I always do from the very beginning is a collaborative, comprehensive health and safety plan involving everybody and covering all aspects from beginning to end of the hazards and controls. And it contains the chemicals being used, their flash points and evaporation rates, which are directly correlated. The lower the flash point, the faster a solvent's going to evaporate. Naturally, ones with lower evaporation rates are desirable, but you can't always pick what you want. Application methods, application rates, the application volumes of chemicals, the spatial size and configuration, the openings that can be used for ingress, egress, ventilation exhaust and ventilation makeup air, and staging the rescue team, prevention of ignition sources, ventilation equipment placement, and measurements, calculations, the confined space permitting, the attendants and the supervisors, the PPE and clothing, the respiratory protection, the atmospheric testing, the worker OSHA exposure monitoring, where you're wearing organic vapor badges to get the solvent exposures after the fact, after lab analysis, the communications between all, especially the attendants, rescue team, and the entrants, and the rescue team and rescue. Everybody gets trained on the health and safety plan, including all other applicable OSHA training. And just in conclusion, great, specific, timely communication and never assuming anything, but instead verifying everything is always essential.
Great. Yeah. And in terms of on these projects where you, the compliance audit, why is it important to audit your contractors? And talk about, you know, what is your audit involve? When do you audit? How often do you audit these contractors for confined space projects?
Well, that's a great question. I get approached on an ongoing basis by prospective painting contractors that want to work for us, and I'm not exaggerating, they're never completely OSHA compliant, sometimes not even close, and they don't understand exactly what these regulations require, how they're triggered, and how to comply with them. So, I mean, even good contractors can not understand this stuff. It's really rare to find painting contractors that know a fair amount about this. So, in order to approve contractors, first of all, you have to give yourself a corporate authority to do that. And I did that in our corporate compliance policies and programs. For example, in our confined space program, in our written respiratory protection program, I give industrial hygiene final authority on approving contractors, selecting contractors as being OSHA compliant to perform this work. Even contractors that become compliant can still lapse, and you have to periodically audit them, maybe annually at least, but you've on a project basis, you have to evaluate contractors, even ones that were formerly totally compliant. So it's, as I mentioned, most contractors aren't even close to becoming compliant with all these regulations. They don't understand. You've got to also obtain support from project management and sourcing to have this kind of authority. I've had multiple cases where these contractors that wanted to be approved complained up the chain of command, like my one, about me claiming I was being unreasonable and going overboard because they didn't understand what OSHA really requires. Most frequently, contractors require extensive assistance and must be highly motivated to persevere to become compliant. I recently assisted two of my blasting painting contractors over a 1.5-year period each before I could finally approve them as compliant, giving me a total of 5 approved flammable toxic confined space spray painting contractors for all our states. I also have another contractor that I approved for spraying all solids coatings for immersed applications, but I would not let them spray flammable toxic coatings in confined spaces. We'll help those contractors persevering because it's for the sake of helping them to protect their workers who aren't adequately being protected. Many give up or make insufficient progress. Some we will never approve due to lack of trust. And I've eliminated contractors for claiming they were using explosion-proof ventilation when I found out they didn't in one case many years ago. So we have I created an audit checklist for approving contractors and annual audits, and it's kind of a systematic checklist that shows incrementally what they have done to achieve compliance in all these different areas. And I have provided that to Jerome, and he's posted it on his website. And so, Jerome, could you explain how they could locate this and use it? It's customizable.
Sure. Just let me ask a few questions just for clarification. So your audit checklist, it's specific to spray painting inside confined spaces.
Correct, but it could also be used for manual brush and roller painting or solvent cleaning or degreasing also with flammable toxic solvents.
Okay, and so it's kind of in a table format, so you have the columns of process, and then next column is task, and then you have the hazards. Then you have various applicable OSHA standards such as HAZCOM, Restore Protection, Personal Protective Equipment, classified locations, electrical permit required confined spaces, air contaminants, and things of that nature, and different confined OSHA requirements after that. Then you have various questions that where you're actually checking on the contractor's compliance status, such as their compliance with the HAZCOM program. So is this something that you actually request to look at and you evaluate yourself, or is there somebody, how do you go about?
I have two other colleagues that have a background in this. One is a refinery industrial hygienist and an OSHA compliance officer. And another is in contractor safety also, that's been helping me for years with these generator confined space spray painting projects. He's a CIH and CSP. The former one I mentioned is a CSP. So we all do this together. I have the final say because I'm industrial hygiene, and that's the way I wrote our programs for that reason. And just because you're an industrial hygienist doesn't mean you know any of this stuff or a CIH either. It's highly specialized. It's a lot of times contractors or organizations assume professionals in our field know all this stuff just because we're professionals, and nothing could be further from the truth. Everybody has specializations or areas they're more expert in.
Okay, so it's about 15 questions or a checklist item that you evaluate. And you do this on an annual basis or on a per project basis?
I do it as an initial approval of contractors to ascertain where they're at. And they don't just tell me. In the final column, as you've noticed, by each specific requirement, I use like a bullet system where I have a large bullet that's either red, like a red light that everybody starts out with by each sub requirement. And once they prove through submittals or direct observation by, you know, showing us all their equipment and qualifications and written programs that are OSHA required. And those programs have to be compliant. They can't just be generic canned programs you buy, like we've seen hundreds of examples of, like contractor respirator programs that never say what respirator is required to be worn for doing anything. It just says ridiculous things like we'll figure it out on the job or the supervisor will decide. That's not an OSHA compliant written program. That means their training materials aren't OSHA compliant either. They have to be highly specific, explaining what the requirement is that they're triggering, followed by exactly how they're going to comply with that requirement. Then once I can ascertain for sure through personal verification they're compliant on these sub-aspects, I'll turn that bullet green. And then they aren't approved until the entire list has been verified and turned green. Okay, then, I would audit them annually, and I also check the entire crew's qualifications and equipment and everything prior to each project. I've had cases where contractors that have done this for a while they had to wear FR clothing and showed up without it, or, you know, had non-explosion proof fans installed. And I got there and said, what's this doing here? You know, and you can't just go rent this conductive ductwork in these fans either. They're expensive, and there's a long lead time on procuring flux ducting, and we use vast amounts of it to duct flammable toxic vapors outside buildings.
What I'm hearing is that you also do on-site evaluations of the contractor's performance and compliance with what you expect. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I think the biggest takeaway is don't ever assume anything. You have to personally verify everything. You can't take anybody's word for anything. You have to verify it. And you got to field inspect to make sure during the work they're actually doing this stuff. I go out on all our projects. I've worked every holiday there is inside power plant generators by necessity, personally directing this work. You know, I'm not just going to say, okay, it sounds like you're doing everything right over the phone. It's way too dangerous for that. When you have real flammable atmospheres, and in particular, you're generating flammable toxic atmospheres.
Well, that looks like a great compliance audit form available to the listeners on the Spear and Lancaster website. I want to thank our listeners. I want to thank our experts and encourage you to join us again next time for our podcast with the safety experts.
According to his power that is at work within us.